Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
As promised, Charles Lipson is our guest. Charles Lipson, the professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, the Ritzma chair, and our friend, good friend of ours. And I have a question for him. Jeff Carlin is here again, as always. Jeff is the executive producer at WGN Radio. And me, I'm John Cass, your friendly conservative, doesn't like to make waves or back no losers. But I'm, you know, plodding along, writing my columns for John Cass News, and I hope you come to it and subscribe, $50 a year or $5 a month. We have a piece that maybe we'll talk about. Let's begin there, okay? Because the issue is not just me, it's everyone. I want to know what you guys think. Here's the premise of an article I've just written, that just as Donald Trump yanked the George Bush dynasty out of the Republican Party by the roots, he had the guts to do it, go after that dynasty and rip them out by the roots. Will someone please save the Democrats and do the same thing to Barack Obama?
Jeff, you want to take that
sure.
one?
That's the tokenism? I don't understand. Being as the leftist of all of you, I love the piece because the piece is great. I mean, it is Obama's disaster, whatever's left of the Democratic Party, because he is the ranking feller. But I think they didn't stand it, because, he came up from the Chicago machine. I mean, he's as combined as anybody as far as his origin story. That's always the du jour story that everybody wants to focus on. That's his origin, right? And so I don't think he deviated as much as that. I think his guilt in all this, John, it was my response to it, was that, he let the party get pulled into the DEI tornado, and he's at the helm.
He created DEI.
Well, no,
he's
father. I mean, it was percolating around it, because there isn't that jump, right? If he's brought up in the machine, I know he's part of like the Bill Ayers era. And so it was that whole, that socialist, the workers mentality, we're one, we are all, yada, yada. It's certainly alive in him, but I think he was, because you don't just move that fast, right? Because I mean, like that Clintonian era, and this is my lifetime, right? I feel like there's this weird, unexplainable jump in push, in shift to the left. That is, if you looked at it on policy and the way things moved over history, you look at the graph, there's a spike, there's an unexplainable jump. And I don't think it was just Obama. I think it was Obama opening the door and then not having the gall to stand up and be like, well, we got to draw the line somewhere, because society can't move that fast. And they didn't do that. And I think that's the real guilt.
I think that's right. I think that there's a cleavage that has now opened up in terms of the direction that the Democratic Party can go in the future.
Right.
And I think one direction will be the continued progressive line. They move further and further left. I would say that, call it AOC or Barack Obama or whatever you want to call it. And I think that the other would be to try to move back toward a Bill Clinton center left position. But the crucial point is that their leadership is old. Mm-hmm. They were defeated and have been tarred by defeat. They really engineered the defeat. They weren't able or were unwilling to try to push Biden out early. Mm-hmm. Once they left him in, they were stuck because of identity politics. They couldn't bypass a black woman who was in the number two position. They would have alienated a key part of their base. And she was just a dreadful candidate. But and they were stuck with policies that had not worked. You have between 75 and 80% of the people saying that the country's on the wrong track, and you're an integral part of that administration, you've got a problem. But I would just say that the Democrats won't have a new leader until, at the very least, they win back one of the houses of Congress. But even then, I don't think they'll have a new leader until they nominate somebody for president in 4 years. Because, but I do say, here's a signal I would look for. If Barack Obama sells his house in Washington, that's a key thing to look for. Because he's the only president since Woodrow Wilson. Presidents always leave Washington. Woodrow Wilson was very sick. And he stayed in Washington. Barack Obama stayed in Washington so he could continue to direct a kind of weak presidency under Biden. And the Biden presidency is now a shambles. Right. He's in. He's competing with Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan and a few others for the worst presidency in American history.
But I don't think it's a good thing for the. I know this might seem odd. I'm trying to find a conservative reason for this, but I don't think it's a good thing for the country, for the republic, to only have one wing, like the right wing,
right,
the conservative wing. I really would like the Democrats to also be vibrant, but I see as long as this Barack Obama thing is hanging over their heads, they can never deal with what they have to do, which is to denounce racism, root and stem, and pull it out of their party. But if identitarian politics is the creed, how can they do that?
Yeah, and they're deeply committed to one of the most important things that's holding back impoverished areas of big cities, which is the teachers unions. So how are you going to create people who are ready for the more intellectually intensive job markets of the future if you've got really bad schools combined with a lot of children from one-parent households where the one parent is ill-equipped to give them the kind of intellectually enriched upbringing that they need? It's a terrible tragedy. But in effect, since LBJ, the Democrats, in an effort to create a, quote, great society and to win the, quote, war on poverty, have in fact done one good thing, which is wiped out the very worst kind of poverty where people didn't have food and so forth. But they have also created a dependence on the state, especially among poor people, where you have a much greater number of people. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it was by design.
I don't know if whether it was by design or not, but the question is, can they get out of it? And I think that's one. I don't think they know how to get out of it, but I think that the Trump administration and this DOGE project to cut back government, that will be one of its biggest challenges.
Jeff?
I mean, it will be one of the biggest challenges. I mean, the stuff they keep throwing out there, and this is, I mean, John, you remember this back to the you know, WLS days when we were looking for fodder, where all this waste book spending things, and you know, that a lot of grant programs and stuff, and all that stuff's great. but
shrimp
also
on a treadmill,
right? Exactly. You know, the love making proclivities of, you know, Alaskan peregrines on coke, you know, whatever it is. It's
I read those magazines right. for the articles.
I like the cartoon, but but the reality is that, you know, even if you tried to cut like $1 trillion out of the budget, you'd still have it just wouldn't even be enough to cut. I mean, you could remove every employee from the budget and it would still, you'd only take out $1 trillion if that.
That's a crucial point.
Where do they go? That's where I want to know.
Let me push back on you.
Yeah, that's my curiosity is like, what are they going to do? I mean, we know those are certain things, but a lot of the jokes have always been the golden toilets that are in, I suppose, an aircraft carrier, really. It's really not. It's just all this other black market or black money that's spent within our government. Like, how are they going to get to that stuff?
I think this is really important. And by the way, I think this will divide Republicans, not in a public way, but I think there'll be a lot of defenders of the deep state. Mm-hmm. I agree with what you said, but I think it's only part of the story. I think it's absolutely right that cutting a number of employees in the government will not save the huge amounts of money that need to be saved if we're to be on a financially sustainable.
And there's a ripple out from people becoming unemployed in mass numbers too, that, you know, that you can't sustain.
Right. Right. And the mark of that will be whether the price of houses goes down in Bethesda. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that the real weight that needs to be pulled off of America is two things. One, we have an increasingly centralized government in Washington. That happened since Franklin Roosevelt. It changed fundamentally the way America is governed. And we never really made a fundamental decision that that's what we wanted to do. But we are now not just governed by from Washington, but we're governed mostly by mid-level bureaucrats, so that Congress no longer really passes laws very often. What it mostly passes are these broad umbrella provisions that say in a bill some 2,000 times sometimes, that the secretary of whatever department shall determine. And then, of course, the secretary doesn't determine that. That's something that mid-level bureaucrats make these rules and regulations and then pass them. Those are those are anti-democratic. They're centralized in Washington. And they're a very heavy weight on all the little businesses and individual people who have to comply with them. That's a big burden. And that, I think, is going to be absolutely crucial. And assisting this DOGE effort are some major rulings that come out of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is now saying that bureaucrats can't simply make rules and then have the courts defer to them. It's not that the courts are going to make the new rules. It's that the courts are going to say Congress cannot delegate those powers under the Constitution. It can't delegate those powers to the executive bureaucracy. Right,
the specifics, like, you know, Congress says, hey, water should be safe. And then they say, but we let, you know, Joshua, PhD, or whatever, to decide what safe means.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you end up with these situations where somebody digs a small pond to feed their cattle on an upland in Montana.
That is their case.
And then that's called violating the waters of the United States Act by a bureaucrat.
That is true.
$70,000 fine per day they wanted to put on that guy. If he hadn't had a pro bono conservative legal foundation that was willing to fight it all the way to the Supreme Court, he would have just had to concede to them.
So where is the answer? Because I see them over my lifetime, the Congress has been given up this power to the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy then supports those that it deems its allies and opposes those that it deems its enemies. It's almost like a Roman or Byzantine, I hate to use that word because people hate Greeks with it, but something like that. And at the same time, the the government, our government, has to free itself from this stranglehold of the bureaucracy.
I think that's
right. When is that going to happen?
Well, I think, well, look, first of all, it's true that the Democrats don't have a leader, but they do have an opponent, and that's Donald Trump and his big initiatives. So one question will be whether they will come together to oppose a lot of these initiatives. They won't oppose them in principle. Who could oppose cutting costs and being more efficient? What they'll do is look for the highest profile, what they would consider mistakes or people who get cut off, and then they'll highlight those in particular. And it won't just be Democrats. There are a lot of Republicans who are essentially establishment figures, and they will be defending the particular bureaucracy where they placed people. One more point. I certainly agree that these bureaucrats really try to punish their opponents. And look at the vote in Washington. I think Trump got like 6% of the vote in D.C.
Right.
I mean, they hate him. But they also want to expand their own power and reach as a bureaucracy.
Okay.
And one of the problems with that, besides the one that I've spoken about, which is the deadweight cost that it imposes, is that these and the anti-democratic quality, is that the crux of American central policy, federal government, is that we have divided the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. But within bureaucracies, those are combined so that they make the rule, then they implement the rule, and then if you don't like it, they have a little kangaroo court in their bureaucracy to determine if you complied. So there's a centralization of power, all three branches within the government. And they've begun to do one more thing that's even sneakier, and this really began under your friend Barack Obama. We think of them as passing rules and regulations, and they're rules about how they can pass a regulation. They have to publish it, and then they have to have public comments and sometimes hearings and all of that. Right. But they've under Obama, they started doing something newer and more insidious. They could send a letter to you that says, John Cass and Jeff Carlin, you run a podcast and we have rules about podcasts, but you should, it's called a dear friend letter. And you should know that if you do it this way, we consider that fine, and you have, in effect, a safe harbor, end of letter. Implied, if you do it any other way, we can come after you. And it's not even a rule or a regulation. It's a dear friend letter that tells you what they plan to enforce. And nobody has any counter against it.
It tells you that inside the soft glove, there's a fist that will break your jaw, right?
Right. Exactly. But they don't have to go through the rules and regulations, which are normally constrain the passage of any new regulation.
This also applies across parties and intra parties.
Right.
Like, for example, I'll throw one out to you. And I think you've written about this, like in the past in books, and you've taught this. The Defense Department is not upset with Biden. The Defense Department people, the people in Congress, that the Washington that feeds off the defense contracts, the McConnells and that side of the combine, and Democrats too, they're happy with what's going on. Oh, miss an audit? Oh, you missed 7 audits? Oh, that's okay. Keep going. But they see this fellow that is being offered to them, Pete Hegseth, as a revolutionary force that they have to destroy. Because it's not about whether Pete Hegseth had a few drinks on a trip and maybe went to bed with one of his colleagues or something. It's about money in the billions and billions and trillions. Yes or no, Tony?
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's about, we keep kind of circling back this, but the control of power, it doesn't matter. I mean, the machinery that is the, you know, the military governmental complex is going to persist in one way or another. You know, that's what I think, that's here to stay. And I think it's part of what makes the United States a, you know, a dominant force globally, just as it is. I think it's a power thing, you know, John. I think they don't want to give up what they have. They don't want an outsider. They look down on him. I mean, that's going to be the play. They're going to minimize him, like you said, take some scandal, make, you know, hang it around his neck, and then say, well, he's not prepared. He doesn't have to do this degree, or didn't go to that school, or, you know, doesn't know this place, people, or wasn't in that think tank or at that place, or whatever it is.
But Jeff, the warfighters like this guy.
Well, that's
the
fine.
The warfighters, the guys on the boots on the ground, see another one like them.
Yeah, but I think, you know, qualifying boots on the ground in any of the, you see, you people always go and make that argument, right? It's not this monolith that only goes one way or another, and they're, you know, a zeitgeist is anything, they move with the times, so it's short term, whatever it is that's against authority or in their favor, they're gonna go for it. People always say that, you know, Democrats will say that, oh, they hate Trump, boots on the ground people don't like Trump, or they'll turn it around. I never fall for that. I think the fact that he comes from, you know, this other side of the media coin, so nobody's friendly with him. He's not one of ours. He's not their ilk. You know, that's the mentality. And so keep him at arm's length, handcuff him whenever we can, or keep him out of the castle to begin with. Because once he's in, then he's going to let his friends in, much the way, if you want to flip it, the way Obama would have, you know, did, you know, let his friends in into the castle and start poking around. I think it's the deep state of not wanting to lose their control. In a Hegseth who they don't know, who's not part of them, is really why they're afraid of him.
I have a view that may be different from both Jeff and John. I certainly think that Hegseth is an outsider. I certainly think that from what we know now, they're smearing him with unsubstantiated allegations. But I do think that there's a problem, a different problem, with his nomination. Not that I would vote against it on the basis of what we know now, but the Pentagon, the U.S. Defense Department, is the single largest employer on the planet Earth. And you just need to have people who have really serious management experience and probably government management experience. I have no doubt that Ron DeSantis would be a much more effective manager of that huge bureaucracy. I mean, he's done a fabulous job in Florida.
He was a JAG officer. I mean, that puts him a bit more in hands-on. And that's
right. But I think what Hegseth can really do is improve recruitment, because he'll be the face of the modern army. Come in, be like me, you can rise up. And I think that's all to the good. And as I say, I'm not at present convinced by the allegations against him. They look to me like the smears that were done against Supreme Court nominees and other things. But I am not convinced. If you don't have managerial experience, the people who are buried inside these bureaucracies will run circles around you.
Yeah, right.
And it's a yes minister problem, if you remember that TV series where they just say yes. One final point. You are right to say that there'll be a lot of other people who are appointed here. America's almost unique. In many other governments, Western European democracies, you would, in effect, appoint the Secretary of Defense, but nobody else in the whole bureaucracy there.
Right.
Everybody else would be a senior civil servant, and they would be protected. America, you appoint almost four levels deep. I mean, there are tens of thousands of appointees, and I think one of the things that will differentiate this Trump administration from the first one is that they know a lot more people to put in those positions. And I think what really scares...
And they've been prepared for it.
That's right. I think what really scares the Democrats and an overlapping group, which is, in effect, the permanent government, is that people like Kash Patel and know where the bodies are buried. Right. Transparency will be their enemy.
And Kash Patel has made no secret that he wants to find them, dig them up, and drag them around the walls of Troy for everyone to see.
Right. And that's going to be a big deal. That's going to be a big deal. It's not. They're worried about sort of vengeful prosecutions, and Trump has given them a lot to work with because he said, I want revenge. But the real problem is going to be the document trails that they've all left.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we have, for example, the 51, the famous 51 of the intelligence officers.
Right.
Who said, oh, this is Russian disinformation, this laptop.
Do you know who organized that?
That was Blinken. What's his name? The Secretary of State.
Blinken was a key person, and so was Jake Sullivan.
Yes.
They weren't the public names in front of it.
Right.
But they were the people, and they were rewarded.
So what's the retribution look like then? I mean, aren't these most of these guys already in civilian roles that where they're using their influence to get rich? I mean, or sell books and things. I mean, what does the government do then? And you're bringing up criminal charges. I mean, okay, but they've been how long out of the game? Where are you going to get the criminal charges? I mean, that are going to be.
This is an issue, actually. You raise a great point, Jeff, because take some of the issues about the Biden family corruption.
Right.
Uh-huh. On the one hand, you'd like to see it fully exposed. And if people have been granted pardons, as Hunter has, and they'll have to grant the brother a pardon, so he won't go be tried, and issues come out in his trial, that's one thing. But on the other hand, the American public really wants the government to move forward. We have real problems in the country, and people want to see those solved. They don't want to see Congress always looking backwards. So it's going to be a tough balancing act, don't you think, John?
I think that there's going to be a lot of screaming. I mean,
I remember in 2 years.
Have you ever had a tooth pulled? I just had a tooth pulled. All right. And, you know, the dentist, the very, very good dentist, and he's good because it was relatively painless. He said, do you want to keep this? I said, what? I'm going to put it around a bleeping gold chain? No, but I said, let me see it. It was like the size of I had a horse here, a horse head.
John, I've always said that you were a toothless commentator.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Now it really, you've proved it. I mean, you're going the full distance.
But you see those molars? Think of it being pulled out without anesthetic.
Yeah.
That's what the combine is thinking about.
And by the way, John, you should write about, you're using the term combine, which everybody in Illinois knows was the way that our state government was run with an agreement. But I think that has a kind of analogy to the establishmentarian Republicans and Democrats in Washington. And I think you should apply that term to and talk about what it would mean.
So I should redefine the term and get myself an easy column to sit down.
I think so, and split the revenue with me.
Hey, you get a book about it, The Modern Combine. There you go.
Yeah.
It's not the Uniparty. I think I like the Combine because that machinery. You see it chopping everything down.
Well, you know, it was a Chicago invention.
Right.
The combine. I'm talking about the first combine, the McCormick combine.
That's what I was referring to all the time. Right. I remember
exactly.
I had a great lunch with Chris Roebling at the Union League Club, and I think we had cigars afterward. And then sat around, talked about this what people call the Uniparty, and hashed out this idea of a combo. This because it's Republican and Democrats, right?
I think that's what's going to be the opposition to Trump, and it'll be subterranean in Washington as they try to roll back what Doge does. It'll be, in effect, the combine. But I think that the combine was defeated within the Republican Party when he defeated Jeb Bush. And I think that the Democrats, they really have two wings of the party. People, maybe three. People, one is the sort of center left, call it the Bill Clinton wing. Another is the populist left, which is the Bernie Sanders AOC, current AOC. She'll move on this. And the third wing is Elizabeth Warren. She's sometimes grouped with Sanders, but that's not right. She is the voice of the left-wing bureaucracy. And that's who the combine will really try to work with.
That's really good, Charles. And I will have to call you and have another conversation when I when I sit down and write. Well, speaking of pain that's coming, okay?
Yeah.
In Chicago, we have a mayor, Mayor Panic Attacks, Mayor Johnson, who's freaking out every 5 minutes. And I don't know why. Maybe something happened in his personal life and he had to find $80,000 to lard on his wife's office or something. Whatever he did. Oh, did I say something? The point being.
Just taking notes.
The point, just remember that. File it away. But the point being that we are going to see it's a lot of screaming when the hard sheriff. Because I love Larry McMurtry novels, the Texas Cowboys. The hard sheriff, Tom Holman, comes into power. He's going to begin to throw people out of this country again.
Well, that's right.
And we're going to have a lot of the media will find, as Charles told us earlier on this on other issues, they will find the most high-profile, most sympathetic figures to elevate to like sort of a public drama and tell the story about the poor grandmother of the abuela who was being kicked out by the evil sheriff and deported. And I don't think that's going to be very pretty.
Did you see something very interesting that Trump looks like he's trying to do, which is he's talked about opening up a pathway for dreamers. Only in the last day. And I think this is incredibly shrewd, actually, as a way to solidify a really major change in the base of the Republican Party. They are capturing the Hispanic vote.
And they already assimilated.
Yeah. The second generation.
Yeah.
Exactly. And this is a big deal. And I think, but, you know, Trump, he's not going to give that away. He's going to demand the Democrats give him not only the border wall, but a lot more, before he agrees to something that they really want. Otherwise, he's going to say, you're the one that's stopping it. So I think there's something very interesting going on. The problem with deportation won't be with the gangs. The problem will be when you come to people who've been in the country for 30 years and haven't committed any crime other than coming in the country illegally. I hate the term undocumented because the problem isn't that they forgot their documents.
Right.
I mean, it's like the term gender affirming care. I mean, it's just El Crapola.
And when they come for meat processing or major corporate farms and stuff, I mean, these places where that then there's going to be an economic ripple out, that's where they're trying to, they've got the wiggle room where you can be like, well, okay, we can avoid that if, and what's our play, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But you'll get corporate pushback, but in addition to the corporate pushback, you'll just have these stories that ordinary Americans who have good hearts are going to say, look, this person's been here for a long time, and we've got to come up with a better solution. We want the law enforced, but, you know, there's got to be a better solution here. So I think there's a lot to be sorted out on this deportation. But Tom Homans looks like he's a new sheriff in town. And by the way, it has split the Democratic coalition because blacks feel like they're competing with illegal aliens for these funds and for some jobs.
Right. And that brings us back to Chicago because, John, to your point, I don't think that Mayor 12% or 16%, whatever it is, approval.
Jesus, it's bad.
I don't think he's going to have the cachet to say, well, no, we're not going to take help for X, Y, or Z, because everyone's going to turn around and look at him who's had their place broken into or has had their car stolen or have seen crime in their neighborhood go up. They're going to say petty thefts, that type of stuff. They're going to say no.
Like, this guy.
I mean, plus, John, don't forget, we do have the new state's attorney who just rolled back the retail theft level back from $1,000 and or 9 previous arrests to 1 or 2, I think it is, and then I think it's $500 again. So we're going to see, you know, there's going to be an uptick in realization that these crimes are being reported because that was their game. Oh, and I won't. Well, there's no charges, there's no crime.
When I see black Chicagoans standing up at a city council meeting, excoriating Johnson. I mean, you've seen all this.
Yeah.
I've seen the news. It is stunning. And the fact is, he and the Democrats have not remembered what happened to a previous mayor, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who was, by all means, was tougher in every way and a deeper thinker in every way.
And national
more
support.
Flexible than this idiot. But remember, Rahm Emanuel thought he was going to cover up his problem with Laquan McDonald by trying to get more support from the Hispanics. And he came up with the card. It was not a voter ID card. It was a Chicago ID.
Yeah, city ID.
Right. I forgot.
Remember? And people.
I forgot it. Yeah.
Black people screamed bloody murder. They were being told that they were get off the bus, you know, or get in the back of the bus. They were losing it.
Right.
And I don't think Mr. Johnson or his or Tony Prinkwinkle or the boss of the teachers union that really runs the city thought about that, did they?
It doesn't look like they did. And I would say that it seems like one job that each new mayor comes in with is to make the previous mayor look good by comparison. Good Lord. I was at a group lunch. I go to a regular group lunch. It's mostly Democrats. And I would say that a third of them roughly supported, maybe a third to a half supported the election of Brandon Johnson. It was like an IQ test, really. But, there is literally only one person in a large room now who supports him, and she works for the city. She doesn't say anything about him, but I mean, basically, all of his support is gone, and the city faces huge financial problems going forward. And Brandon Johnson's solution was to raise taxes, and the city council, for the first time in ages, said, "No, we're not doing it." And so, you know, you just see a kind of breakdown in government. One question I asked this group, it's worth thinking about. I said, can you name me one well-governed progressive city? And they came up with Houston, but Houston just voted in a conservative mayor. He calls himself a Democrat. He's really not. And they voted not to take the more progressive candidate. They also mentioned the only other city they could think of was Denver, and Denver is facing huge problems now with this influx of migrants.
Denver is sort of like the Denver Democrats are like the Jacobin Democrats. Like, we will stand, man the barricades against the federal authority. They're like the, they're, what is this? Is it Denver or is it South Carolina in 1859?
It's George Wallace. It's George Wallace in the schoolhouse door.
Oh, man. So there's so much to write. Again, I can't even keep up with you because there's column idea after column ideas coming out of this podcast. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's as we say about our governor, it's an endless buffet.
That's a fire hose.
Bottomless buffet.
If you think you're going to step in front of the buffet line, you got to come through me. Right?
Well, I'm surprised. I'm actually surprised that all these governors and mayors have said, we're going to resist the enforcement of immigration laws. It's important to point out what they can do and what they can't do. They do not have to cooperate affirmatively. With ICE and the like,
right.
But they cannot obstruct them.
Right. They do.
Well, they do, but it depends on what kind of obstruction it is. For example, they don't have to let them into jails, apparently. Yeah. And I think that there's going to be the Trump administration is going to say, no, you don't have to, but you get a lot of funds from the federal government. And if you don't let us in, we're not going to give you the funds. And conservatives ought to really think about how they're between a rock and a hard place on that, because that's saying that local government and its decisions can be overridden by the federal government using funding power. And that's not something conservatives normally like to see happen.
And it's compounded by all this COVID money evaporating and all these places that we were very liberal that we were just talking about who are coming up short. So they're compounded by the fact that they're going to be short of this alternative funding or that alternative fund.
Jeff, is important in a different, in a second way.
Yeah.
You nailed it. It's that the experts who told us what policies to pursue, and it was most clear in the case of how they handle COVID, have basically been proven wrong. And I think that the whole idea that bureaucracies, the federal bureaucracies, like to rely on is we know better than you. We've been studying this problem for ages and ages. And then you see Elon Musk put up satellites for a tenth or less of the cost of NASA. And their satellites are not, and their trip to the space station isn't working. So people are no longer saying, deferring to the idea that these people are really the experts. They weren't the experts on COVID, and they don't deserve to be deferred to.
And it's even broader than that. I mean, you can take it down the line with a lot of these and pieces here. I'm going to draw it back to your recent column, but the idea that, you know, green energy, you know, I've got plenty of friends who are engineers, electrical engineers, nuclear engineers, mechanical engineers, who, when we came out of high school and college, they all went into these fields because they were burgeoning, you know, they were nuclear, they were in coal, green, it's the future, and it was cool, you know, whatever. They're all retreating back to traditional because the proficiency isn't there. You know, you find that, you know, if I spend all this money and I invest all this money in a bunch of solar panels on a big solar field and a big solar array, well, batteries aren't quite what they are yet, so it doesn't really work, and off-grid, and it's cloudy. Wind farm, nobody wants to build wind farms anymore because it has proven to be way less cost-effective. That the initial input, the upkeep, the bureaucracy.
Well, we only have 12 years to live.
Well, but that's the thing. That's proven. All these experts have come out and said this, so it's fallen apart. And then it's the same thing in this progressive, you know, the social progressivism, the DEI Olympics, you know, has fallen apart because it's proven that they're way ahead of society as far as if they want to, you know, push us in that direction, and that we're not ready for it. Sure. And they overplayed that hand. So to your point, Charles, I mean, in your column, you know, the death rattle of DEI is that. I mean, I feel like that they're just overplayed all their hands and they've all come up short because, like you said, they're following the lead of these quote unquote experts who, again, are dictating all this bureaucracy that's running our lives.
Well, I think that the question really for Donald Trump is whether he can deliver on these promises, because it's one thing to make the promises and it's another thing to deliver on them. And I think if he can begin to deliver on them, and if there's not a recession before the next election,
or a global war.
well, I don't think even the war issue. I think that the big issue is unless there's a, it could be that, but unless there's a big shock or an economic downturn before the next election, what Donald Trump has done is put in place a successor in J.D. Vance, or at least a hoped-for successor, that will keep the MAGA movement in place, which is a reformation of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. It's just a basic change in what that party is and will do. And I think that we're about to see in practice whether they can deliver on the promises and whether they, I mean, think about Reagan. Reagan did a lot, in particular, in effect, winning the Cold War and cutting taxes. But once he was out of office and George H.W. Bush didn't really do much, he presided over the end of the Cold War. But the trajectory of governmental growth continued. And so the question is whether or not Trump can create a permanent inflection point in this centralization, bureaucratization, and anti-democratic growth of government, and whether he can put together a permanent dominant coalition in the Republican Party he has transformed.
And that's why we have the greatest jobs in the world.
Really?
Because we're going to be watching this,
yeah,
and we're going to be writing about this. And Charles Lipson, everyone who's listening to me, you can go to charleslipson.com to read all his articles. I would suggest you subscribe to them. Wall Street Journal, The Telegraph, Spectator World, and on and on. I particularly love the one that you wrote in 3rd December, the Democrats after the deluge.
Yes.
Losing parties always search for explanations when they lose big. When they lose the White House and both houses of Congress, that search becomes a full-scale reckoning. And it does, Charles. Read Charles Lipson, charleslipson.com.
Thank you very much, John and Jeff. I love talking with you guys.
Well, our pleasure and our honor always. Thank you, Charles.
For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, the University of Chicago, writer, thinker, teacher, friend. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, my friend and co-host here on the Chicago Way podcast, husband to Christine and friend of Cass, and to me, for me, John Cass, executive editor, is that a fancy name? It's a fancier title than bottle washer. For the johncassnews.com, we can always get a good cup of common sense. Join us again next time, won't you, for another edition of the Chicago Wake podcast on WGN Plus.